are nothing but a gutless, yellow, stinking coward with no sense in the world to step your feet right in here. Now here I am. I'm standing right here waiting on you.
No!
Come on!
No, don't do it! Macho!
Come on, man!
Don't do it! The official trying to get Randy Savage down from there! Don't blow it, Macho! Oh, no. Don't blow it!
He's going for it!
He's going... Wait a minute! Jake Roberts with a clothesline! Down goes Randy Savage!
From Television City in Hollywood...
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown is taped in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 65 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winston. And today, going back to one of my favorite periods to cover. In fact, I've done it before a long time ago, and I wanted to at least let it go for several months before I return to this month and year for the World Wrestling Federation in November of 1991. In this case, Superstars from November 23rd. And this is the second show from the taping in question that I will have covered. It was episode, I want to say it was 19, that I covered the show before this week, which was headlined by the funeral parlor with Hulk Hogan, where he is confronted by Ric Flair. A very historic moment that I don't want to say it gets overlooked, but this is Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair together on screen for the very first time. Oh, yeah, and you also have Piper Savage, Undertaker, and Paul Bearer all in the same segment and all that. So before I get to that, I'll get in my plugs real quick. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Give me a follow on Twitter, @GFAllentownPod. You're probably listening to the show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed in association with Place to Be Nation. Go to placetobenation.com/Amazon to make your Amazon purchases. A portion will be kicked back to Place to Be to help with site costs. I made a very small purchase the other day. I just bought an MP3 song. Even though I know that there are ways to illegally download stuff, I had a kind of a large credit on Amazon, so... Like, why am I purchasing absolutely by 9 days? Because I wanted to relive the year 2000 for whatever reason. The summer of that year was okay, I guess. It's part of my wrestling watching, it seems, that I realized is trying to recapture a bit of my childhood, especially, you know, with this 1991 show, going back to being 12 years old and actually seeing it happen and just being really shocked by certain events that took place on this show. As for my weekend, I mentioned last week that I was going to Long Island for two consecutive weekends for First Communions. Well, in the immortal words of Marsha Brady,
something suddenly came up.
No, I did not score a date with the hunky Doug Simpson. Marsha dropped her date, who was some square dude with glasses, so she could go out with QB1. And then she learned a very important lesson at the end of the episode. In my case, on Friday, I was working at home so that I could go to Long Island immediately after finishing work and get down there sooner rather than leaving from work or whatever. And I noticed that something was very wrong with my 15-year-old cat, Brady, in that she was going around the house trying to pee in weird spots, but couldn't get like one droplet out, just to be graphic or whatever. I owe it to the cat because, you know, she is most weeks 100% of the studio audience for Greetings from Allentown. So I took her to the vet on, I wouldn't say an emergency visit, but they got me in there in about an hour, and I stopped working for about 2 hours and took care of that. And part of it was I had to medicate her every 12 hours with this syringe thing that you kind of have to stick in her mouth and push down on. It's like a plastic thing. So they give me six of those. So over 3 days, I'm going to have to apply that. And as I speak right now, I've done it four times. And she seems a lot better. So that's the good news there. The only thing is, this cat, I'm pretty much the only person in the world who could administer this sort of medicine. I could not ask a relative to do that because she has kind of a reputation for, well, she's on Prozac. So that's not something you see in cats very often. It was kind of an experimental thing that just happened to work. Which, by the way, the fact that she's on Prozac is kind of funny because supposedly that also helps with urinary tract issues. So I'm kind of left scratching my head there. So well worth whatever the hell the vet bill was. You know, when you have a pet that's been with you for 15 years through the ups and downs, I mean, I came into owning this cat because my roommate in Las Vegas at around the time of what was actually Super Bowl 38 when the New England Patriots beat the Carolina Panthers left me this cat and moved out. I had said, oh, I'll think about taking the cat or whatever, and I never spoke to her again. Yeah, I had a female roommate who had a falling out with her boyfriend who apparently lived there before me. It's really kind of a odd deal when I think back on that. I've been told that she was actually very hot, but I don't know if it was because of the fact that I was rooming with her in like a two-bedroom apartment in Rhodes Ranch, you know, just outside of Las Vegas, that I made myself not notice the fact that she was hot because, you know, she was in there, but she wasn't home very much, so I really didn't see her. But apparently my friend, when he was sleeping on the couch, like saw her in like a bathrobe and still discusses it to this day. So let's just hope everything is okay on the cat front. So I've just kind of been sitting around the house in between medication, watching wrestling on the weekend, you know, just various things. Survivor Series 1991 is obviously something that would come up because of the research for this show. I watched the superstars from 2 weeks before this as well. And when I say that this was a pretty famous taping from Fort Wayne, Indiana, a lot of things were going on and in motion leading up to this pay-per-view. You had a number of different injuries that happened that forced substitutions. And then there were other subs on the Survivor Series, such as for Jim the Anvil Neidhart, who was out with an injury from a match with Ric Flair that was on the November 9th Superstars. It's pretty unclear why Anvil was kind of written out of that. Maybe it was just the fact that they could get a better guy in there and probably still gave him a payday. I'm not entirely sure. It was also the Beverly Brothers beating him down after Flair had put him in the figure four. So nice little heat spot for the Beverly Brothers when they didn't get too many of those during that time. Big Bully Busick walked out on the company around this time. After this taping, but before all of this would have aired, his last TV match is actually on this show, challenging for the Intercontinental title. What a way to go out with your last match. Of course, he recently passed away. Forget exactly how old he was, but it was apparently a battle with cancer that had lasted several years. So kind of a tough deal there. So yeah, he is facing Bret Hart on this show. But also behind the scenes, you've got Ricky Steamboat getting fired, but it was actually kind of brilliant what he did in that he refused to do jobs, it seems, on this show for both IRS and The Undertaker. I may have mentioned this in the earlier episode that I did on this taping, that I thought it was hilarious how death and taxes were offered to Ricky Steamboat. He refused, and then he was fired. And he turns up in WCW on Clash of the Champions 17 as a great surprise that led to one of the great Arn Anderson disgusted faces when it is revealed that he is the mystery partner of the Natural Dustin Rhodes on that show. Also one of the best tag matches in WCW's history, counting 89 to 2001 there. I believe the non-compete becomes null and void because of the fact that he got fired. Also, you got Flair confronting Hogan here. You got their house show program that, you know, got underway shortly after the taping. And then you have matches leading up that didn't draw particularly well. A lot of them were double countouts and stuff of that variety. There's a more interesting match at MSG in December where it looks like Flair pins Hogan, but it was a foreign object deal and it gets reversed, and then you get a usual screw job finish later on. I've promoted this narrative more than once that this was something of a mini attitude era in the WWF that kind of got underway, I want to say, with the Sergeant Slaughter and his New Rules campaign after WrestleMania 7, which led to some Desert Storm matches with Hulk Hogan that were really, really good. I think it was the best possible thing that they could have done, given that by that point in time, Slaughter and Hogan could not go like they had in previous years. This is not the Sergeant Slaughter of 1981, but if you can, you know, get a fraction of that, that would be great. You don't have Hogan having to, you know, do anything other than like a crazy sort of brawl that also incorporates the storyline with Slaughter and Hogan. You have snakes getting squished by Earthquake in the spring, Warrior being locked in a casket for 3 minutes and 46 seconds, as covered in episode 12 of Greetings from Allentown, so one of the earliest ones before I joined the Pro Wrestling Only feed. And then things that happened on this taping with a cobra biting Randy Savage. But we'll get to that down the road. You had the Warrior also getting bit with a cobra in the summer, but that kind of got forgotten in those little vignettes that he was doing with Jake to establish Jake Roberts as a heel and aligned with The Undertaker. This Attitude Era, this mini Attitude Era, holds up a lot better than the 98 through 2000, 2001 stuff, at least to me. Not because there were great matches or anything like that on pay-per-view. You know, in watching Survivor Series 91, kind of falls off a cliff after the Hogan-Undertaker match, which wasn't even that good to begin with. It was almost kind of like a squash. Just the way it finished, the crowd was a little bit out of it, even though they were cheering The Undertaker much of it. But this, I find this to be rewatchable immensely. I love late 91 WWF. Flair coming in really freshens up the product. I understand why this wouldn't necessarily be for everyone. Some of it was a little over the top. I don't want to say that Memphis influenced this in any way, but it does have a bit of a Memphis-y sort of feel to it. But when it comes right down to it, and you think of the way they changed things later in 1991, where you have these serious angles, think earlier in the year, you have the whole steroid scandal starting to come home. The chickens are coming home to roost on that front. And there is a saying, I've been doing this rewatch of the TV show Mad Men over the last month or so, and I just finished through season 3, so I'm getting close to halfway through the series. And Don Draper has a saying,
if you don't like what is being said, change the conversation.
And I think maybe this is something the WWF was trying to accomplish in late 1991 with the steroid scandal circling not only around them, but around their main star, Hulk Hogan, and threatening to just bring him down. You have the sex scandals in early 1992 that sidelines Pat Patterson and other guys for quite a while, that took them a while to sort of shake. So with all that going on, you don't really want people talking about that. So you're going to have stuff like Randy Savage getting bit by a cobra, because if you're going to talk about the WWF, you say, holy shit, did you see Randy Savage took a cobra bite for 40 seconds? You're not going to be talking about steroids or any sort of the embarrassments that were happening to the WWF at that time. So I think it was kind of a PR thing to combat some of the bad news that it was happening with the company. But honestly, I'm not sure that there was really anything they could do to help themselves from a business perspective. I mean, nothing was going to really jumpstart things. When you have all of that going on, they had a lengthy boom cycle all through the 80s, pretty much from 1984 all the way through, maybe with some slight dips here and there where there's sort of a malaise or whatever, but things were pretty strong for a very long time, and you're bound to have a recession after a while. So also in action on this show today, because you can't just do 1 hour of a freaking Cobra Bite and Bret Hart versus Big Bully Busick. As I said, there's 30 matches on this taping. Could you imagine sitting there in Fort Wayne, Indiana? I don't know what day of the week this was in 1991 in October when it was taped, but holy crap, 30 matches. You thought some of these recent WrestleManias were long. Even at 15 matches, that's only half. Now, granted, these are squashes, but you got El Matador, Tito Santana. His teammate at the Survivor Series, the Texas Tornado, is in action as well. Skinner, who I don't recall if he's had a match on Greetings from Allentown, the great Steve Kern. And, of course, Jake the Snake Roberts, before the big angle with Savage, does have a match leading up to that. So with all that in mind, let's jump right into the show. Before we get to the WWF's answer to Sterling Cooper, Vince McMahon, Randy Savage, and Roddy Piper on commentary, do a cold open of the funeral parlor from the week before, where Hulk Hogan is attacked by The Undertaker coming out of the standing coffin, and Ric Flair picks up the WWF title and holds it aloft alongside the WCW/NWA World Heavyweight title. But there is an important distinction between now and then, because the belt is now pixelated, whereas it wasn't on the broadcast last week. And the reason for this is, in the meantime, between the airings, there had been an agreement that he could no longer carry that belt on WWF television, which established the precedent of title belts being the intellectual property of the promotion in question. And this would come up again when Eric Bischoff would let Medusa throw the WWF women's title in the trash because of that precedent. They got into a little bit more trouble with that. So the belt is blurred, and this leads to one of my favorite Ric Flair things ever, because we all know the Nature Boy is very fond of wearing his robes out in public and sometimes not having anything on underneath. So he has a championship belt that he wears around his waist that they now either have to pixelate or put like a black dot over. So every time he opens his robe, and this happened at the Survivor Series, you get this black dot that starts appearing around Ric Flair's crotch, which just makes me laugh hysterically, because you think that Flair is just showing somebody his balls rather than this illicit title belt that they've come to an agreement that can no longer be shown. Eventually, they had made a lookalike belt that was used maybe once, and they said, no, that's too close to the original. And then something that looked like a tag belt, or was a tag belt, that you could kind of see like from the corners, because the WWF tag titles were a very unique design, so you could sort of see what they were. And we get a promo after that cold open where, of all things, Paul Bearer decides to use a famous Roddy Piper quote.
Hogan, just when you think you have all the answers, we change the questions. Oh, you were very surprised at my funeral parlor, weren't you? Your attention was on your casket, but my undertaker surprised you with my sacred vessel, and down you went.
Thinking that a funeral parlor is probably the last place you want to be hit with something by surprise, because you're there for a specific reason, and it's usually not a good one, quite frankly. Now, The Undertaker, he had some words for Hogan as well, and the tone that he cuts is rather unusual. He's not the normal Hogan villain, I don't think, in the post-Andre world, where it was really just kind of Randy Savage in a parade of fat guys. And yes, there was Ted DiBiase, but he was backed up by Andre himself. So the way The Undertaker is being presented, even though he's losing to Ultimate Warrior through the summer of 91 in body bag matches and all that to sort of protect him there, I find that the kooky, you know, maybe corny Gravest Challenge moniker that was given to this match is actually kind of apt.
Hogan, the two rotting souls in that cheap gold crucifix won't be able to save you the next time these eyes look into yours.
That is some friggin' phenomenal stuff. And to punctuate it at the end with the gong and all that, because it had been done in some of the other promos as well, including the one that capped off the telecast of the Survivor Series as they were kind of previewing the This Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view throughout. I remember, you know, just actually watching it recently, I thought to myself, I should have been more annoyed by the fact that they used a pay-per-view to basically promote the next pay-per-view that was actually a bit cheaper, but I knew that I was going to be able to talk my dad into getting the next pay-per-view because he was watching it with me, and he knew that I was not going to be just like lying or something like, oh, dad, you know, rematch or whatever. So we get Vince, Roddy, and Savage, and just in the stand-up with all of them, having three of them there, I don't like it quite as much as the old Vince and Jesse just kind of having a back and forth. Because even when Bruno was there, Bruno wouldn't say anything. It was just letting Vince and Jesse, usually riffing off what Jesse was wearing at the time. And speaking of wardrobes here, this is such a professional wrestling thing. Only in wrestling could you have two out of the three guys on screen wearing shirts with pictures, headshots of themselves on there. In what other sport or venue would you find anything like that with people wearing t-shirts with pictures of themselves on there? Now we have our opening match, which is El Matador, Tito Santana, fresh off the weeks of vignettes showing him going back to his roots to become a bullfighter for whatever reason, because apparently that's what people in Mexico do. He's taking on Bob Smedley. And Tito, he had been wearing the Strikeforce gear for years and years after, well, 2.5 years after he and Martel broke up at WrestleMania 5. But what's interesting is, I mentioned this last week, there is a match between him and The Undertaker in Barcelona, Spain, where Tito defeats The Undertaker, not exactly cleanly, because he hits him with three pile drivers, which none of them were really technically sound. And then he ends up hitting Undertaker with the urn and getting a 1-2-3. It's just very surprising to see Tito Santana in his Strikeforce gear getting a pinfall win over The Undertaker in 1991. Just the optics of it just hit your mind. And I don't know, my mind was a little bit blown by that. The other thing I should note about this show is that Mel Phillips is the ring announcer. No Howard Finkel, there's no Mike McGurk. So make sure guys have, you know, no bare feet. You know, make sure that you're wearing your boots. And in fact, there's one guy here, Kerry Von Erich, Texas Tornado. Probably the only time in his life is seeing Mel Phillips where he's glad that he actually had a foot amputated, so he's going to have less of a problem with Mel Phillips and his weirdness. It is odd that with Tito in this relatively new character, this is not his debut match as El Matador. They're kind of very heavy on the Hulk Hogan talk. They're not really focusing on Tito. So it seems like he's still being relegated to a place where he's background while we talk about more important things. Or as it was known in WCW 1998, pretty much everything that was not involving the NWO was just background to talk about the NWO. I am left scratching my head that I think that being a bullfighter, or particularly a matador, which I think is like the highest class of bullfighter you could possibly be, and I'm putting aside the whole animal cruelty thing of that. It's a tradition in that culture, so whatever. You think it would take more than 3 or 4 vignettes to actually learn how to become a top bullfighter like El Matador claims to be? The one thing in researching bullfighting, you know, for this show, for whatever reason, is the little cape thing that they wave around. It's not so much to get the bull to run after the color red. That has nothing to do with it because of color blindness. The thing that interested me the most is that those, like, capes or whatever actually weigh upwards of, like, 10 to 14 pounds. I thought that that was interesting because they look a lot lighter than that. And they make the point that Tito, in this El Matador character, has become a little bit more aggressive since he went back to his roots, which is something that Vince actually points out on commentary. I had written the note in my notepad, and then Vince said it on the commentary.
And Tito Santana in the square circle right now, far more aggressive, I believe, now that he is El Matador than he has ever been.
He's been fighting bulls, big, nasty, horny toads on him, kind of going to gore him and stuff. What has he got now? He's got a medley with him. That ain't nothing. Tito Santana is ready to survive.
And that's kind of my problem with Piper as a color commentator, particularly in the three-man booth, because I think Savage being there kind of brought out some of Piper's worst instincts. When it was a two-man booth, I think Piper was a little bit more restrained, or at least from a Piper perspective. He's kind of crapping on Tito and the whole gimmick. At least that's the sense that I'm getting. I didn't particularly care for that. And they make an allusion to the Survivor Series match that Tito was in. As I mentioned, he was teamed up with the Texas Tornado, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, and eventually Sergeant Slaughter would join that team. And their opponents, and this is one of the more interesting Survivor Series teams of all time. You can hear me laughing right now, but this crew that they put together as the opponents is so hysterical. You have Skinner, Steve Kern, so good pro wrestler, Colonel Mustafa, the Iron Sheik, now cosplaying an Iraqi colonel or whatever, the Berserker, John Nord, and Hercules, who was actually an improvement over Big Bully Busick, who was originally scheduled for that spot. It just, the little picture of the Survivor Series team that had Big Bully Busick along with those three other guys, I mean, that is one crazy ass team that, you know, where none of the guys really amounted much in their WWF runs, respectively. I don't know who would be the most famous. I mean, I'm not counting Iron Sheik stuff. I'm just counting the Colonel Mustafa. God, what a friggin' team that is. And Tito, he doesn't let Smedley get in any offense other than maybe one right hand, so he's addressed my concern about Tito giving away too much offense in his squash matches. Backdrop, knee drop, and then the new finisher. He had done the flying forearm for a very long time. Figure four leg lock was also part of his repertoire as well, but not necessarily a finisher, just something you would bring out from time to time. Now it is El Paso de Morte, or as Bobby Heenan would call it, El Paso de Salsa. Never failed to get a laugh out of me, where he would make sure you get a guy bent over in the center of the ring, usually with a shot to the gut or whatever, and then would sort of hit similar flying forearm to the back of the head, and that would be his finisher. And nice little victory for Tito here. As I said, I don't need to see him selling for some guy named Bob Smedley for 30 seconds or even 10 seconds. Just go out there and get your win, especially when they're going to spend the first minute or two of your match talking about Hogan and what's going on with him anyway.
And we just saw El Matador in the ring. Tito Santana and his tag team partner set for a match of survival. But at this point, no word as to who, if anyone, will replace the injured Jim the Anvil Neidhart.
And little did we know in 1991 that the question, who will replace Jim the Anvil Neidhart, would actually become a redundancy, a department of redundancy department kind of deal several years down the road when they make him an Abbott and Costello punchline so that Vince and Lawler can just do an obnoxious version of that same bit. But we do get something good out of this. is Survivor Series team promos are always a favorite of mine from those first couple of years of Survivor Series matches. Although I've been watching some Fall 88 shows, and a lot of those promos tend to be just the team captains, probably because there was so much fluidity and, you know, everything being in flux then with substitutions, as there was here. But we get a promo from the Oddball team that I was just talking about, and holy crap. As I said, many of these guys had good wrestling careers at other points in time. You know, Steve Kern and the Fabulous Ones. The Iron Sheik was the WWF champion for 4 weeks in late 83 and early 1984. Berserker, John Nord, Pro Wrestling Illustrated Rookie of the Year, 1985. He had his moments from time to time, trying to stab The Undertaker with a sword. And Busick, well, there's not really a whole lot there. He had worked as an enhancement talent in the late 70s in the WWWF. We get a promo from all these guys, and it's like, with General Adnan there, too, it's like a friggin' Monty Python skit.
Hacksa Jim Duggan, this coming Wednesday, June Luis Arena, we're gonna show you we are the real survivors.
Will you get Duggan's 2x4? Will you get the Sword of the Matador? It makes no difference.
I can't wait for the witching hour this Wednesday night. It's a good night for pain.
Yes. Hey, boy, you know what?
What?
They gotta get another guy.
I just wish there was more fun like that in modern wrestling. It always seems to be some sort of backstage vignette or whatever where you might get something like that, and the batting average seems to be pretty low. But, you know, fun stuff like that where you just gather the four guys and they cut loose like that. And we get another promo from... They had a tag team Survivor Series match where it was different than the 10-on-10 matches that they had had in 87 and 88. In this case, it was just two tag teams together, and they would be eliminated as individuals. And it is the Bushwhackers and the Rockers. I can hardly think of two more disparate teams. And this is the, you know, in the middle of the Rockers going through their troubles. And Shawn Michaels is giving off a bit of a vibe in this promo.
You know something, I'll tell you what. The Survivor Series. One man gets eliminated. He goes back. Another man. And then go on and go on. And if it comes down to 3-1, this Rocker has got to be able to take care of himself.
You know it's called Survivor Series.
That's fantastic. The Survivor Series, buddy. And we're all going to survive. Everybody.
You guys, oh yeah. Our nasty boys.
So Sean says his piece, and then it's Marty's turn to talk, but he only gets about a couple of words out, and then Sean just interrupts him and just steamrolls the rest of the promo. Like I said, he's giving off a bit of a vibe here. And the thing that I would compare it to, and I don't know why I would think of this, because I don't even really like this show all that much. It's kind of like John Travolta being on Welcome Back, Kotter after Saturday Night Fever came out in 1977, when he would make appearances in the last couple of seasons of Kotter. It's like, yeah, he's one of the sweat hogs and all, but he's not like Horseshack anymore. Vinnie Barbarino, he's clearly different. It has nothing to do with any of the on-camera storylines of Welcome Back, Kotter, or any of the internal politics of the sweat hog. It's just, you see John Travolta there, and things are suddenly different, and he's on a different level than all the people around him.
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Who'd have thought they'd lead ya?
Back here where we need ya.
Back here where we need ya.
Yeah, they tease him a lot, 'cause we got him on the spot. Welcome back.
Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Welcome back.
And now, the final television match for Big Bully Busick in his WWF run. You may remember that he disappears and then eventually turns up in the Global Wrestling Federation. I remember watching Global on ESPN, and it had to have been early 1992, where he shows up in effectively the same gimmick, and I just look at him and I'm like, huh, oh, that's where he went. Didn't really think anything of it. Like, he just kind of disappeared, and then he appeared in another promotion. Like, I didn't care that he had left or anything, but let's explore his run, because I'm not sure I'd actually be able to do a show with any of his matches, because there aren't too many of them on TV. In fact, most of them are on primetime wrestling. He did have some matches into November where he would lose to named guys like Texas Tornado, British Bulldog, Hacksaw Jim Duggan. His debut was July 7th of 91. As I said, he was around in the late 70s, but his debut for this run was July 7th in Lowell, Massachusetts, of all places, according to the results on historyofwwe.com. Picked up a win, his first TV match on Wrestling Challenge, August 25th, over the great Mario Mancini. And then he became known for, you know, some bullying things that were going on, famously hassling Mike McGurk on an episode of Challenge where Harvey Whippleman, his manager, is blowing cigar smoke in the face of Mike McGurk, who is just kind of standing there and, you know, like making faces and just kind of coughing when that happens. And this leads to a great moment, actually, where Sid Justice's music hits and he comes down and kills Busick in about 90 seconds. Very classic stuff early on in Sid's run after he had been the guest referee at SummerSlam for that main event. And then some other bullying stuff, which is, you know, pouring popcorn on a young girl's head in the front row, stealing balloons from the very same young girl who just so happened to be Bobby the Brain Heenan's real-life daughter. He also stole a tie from a ring attendant. I don't even know why you would do that. I mean, what are you going to do with the tie? I mean, it's not really just being a bully. It's just kind of being a dick. But it's a lot easier to call him Big Bully Busick instead of Big Dick Busick, because, you know, you got to save that name for ECW and one of the Dudleys down the road. So most of his matches are on primetime wrestling. You don't necessarily see him too much on Superstars and Challenge. Maybe three or four, maybe five matches overall. And he had a very brief feud, as I recall, with the Brooklyn Brawler, which over who was the biggest bully or who was the bully in the WWF. Felt like there was, you know, a bunch of those feuds, like Mountie and Boss Man fighting over who is the law and order of the WWF in the summer. So seemed like something they were going back to, kind of a theme, kind of like gang wars later on. And speaking of the Mountie, Bret the Hitman Hart, the Intercontinental Champion, is in a feud with the Mountie. See, he had a match with him a couple of weeks before that was non-title, and the Mountie was very unhappy about that and asked Bret why this was non-title, and Bret says he could never give a title match to a jailbird. So that infamous loss to the Boss Man and his time, his night in a New York City prison kept getting brought up months after the fact, and the Mountie had water, Jimmy Hart actually threw water on Bret to basically make the shock stick more effective. It's kind of hokey and all that, and I didn't really include that in my mini Attitude Era of like big angles or whatever, but that was during the sweeps period, so they were trying to get something out of that. And very early on in this match, the Mountie has a little inset promo, and Jimmy Hart actually turns out to be right.
Bret Hart, you better get ready, baby, because the Mountie's going to become the next Intercontinental Champion!
Enjoy it while you can, Bret the Hitman Hart!
Because you've already felt the first shot. After you feel the second one, I'm going to be the Intercontinental Champion!
He's not wrong, and he had a hell of a run with the belt for that 48 hours that he had. He certainly ranks in my top 35 Intercontinental Champions of all time. Busick is actually billed from Weirton, West Virginia, a place that, strangely enough, I've been to. I just remember it was like some sort of coal mine or whatever that had this like tower that had a fire at the top of it. And my friend Bob and I, we would always joke that it was the Olympic torch, like somehow they were going to award the Olympics to Weirton, West Virginia. It is kind of in the middle of nowhere. And the only real offense that Busick gets in is the abdominal stretch move. But rather than grabbing the rope like IRS does. You get a new twist where he's holding Harvey Whippleman's hand on the outside, so a little bit of help on that. But Brett eventually powers out of it with the hip toss or hip lock move, but then he ends up getting clothesline, so a little bit more offense from Big Bully. You get a reverse, but on a whip, but looks like somebody screwed up there. It looked like a definite miscommunication. So Brett just kind of punches him in the head. I'm not sure it was something along the lines of, you freaking moron, you do what I say here. Busick apparently was also known as a guy who would not talk in wrestling terminology. Like, he would not refer to things like heat segment and all that. He would say, now, when I get the advantage here, something like that. I've heard that about him. And he did have no formal training being out of the Pittsburgh area. So maybe that was something that was not the best possible thing for his career. Brett then goes right to the five moves of doom, but I don't think he gets all five of them in because we don't get to see the Russian leg sweep because got to protect Virgil's finisher and all that. Although actually he was still using the million dollar dream at that point. Inverted atomic drop, the side backbreaker, and then the elbow off the second rope before he locks in the sharpshooter for a very quick victory over Big Bully Busick, who clearly was being shunted down the card, but he could see that coming, and for whatever reason, he just decided to walk out and go to Global, because in late 91 and early 92, if you really want to make your name and make your star really go as high as it could possibly go, you want to go to the Global Wrestling Federation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
The thing is, we've been sitting back and honing our skills, man. Doing the things that we do best. IRS, what have you done this week?
I've been auditing people. One right after the other, like a cheat like the boss, man.
Okay. These guys, what have you guys been doing this week getting ready?
We've been going around beating people up. The same thing we do in the ring.
Yeah. So natural, huh?
It's an interview with Jake the Snake Roberts' Survivor Series team in the event center. And while he may say that that's natural, I'm going to have to go ahead and sort of disagree with you there, mainly because there's something there that bugs me, and it should bug you if you've ever seen this or watched the lead up to Survivor Series 1991. How the hell is Jake the Snake Roberts so cool with Earthquake so quickly after Earthquake killed his pet snake Damien, which only took place in late April? So we're about 6-7 months past that point, and now all of a sudden they're buddy-buddy and playing grab ass. Now, albeit Jake does not refer to Earthquake by name here, he just kind of says, and you guys, what are you guys up to? IRS sounded like completely unnatural. That sounded like a scripted promo if there ever was one in 1991, at least outside the universe of NBC. It's really bugged me quite a bit seeing them together. And not, like, when I saw that, you know, Randy Savage and Ricky Steamboat teaming together at Survivor Series 1987 after their big feud, that doesn't bother me as much for whatever reason. Maybe there was enough time, at least in that case, I guess it was 8 months since WrestleMania, and they did have some matches afterwards. So maybe there wasn't enough time. So my question I have to pose here is this. How much time needs to pass after a heated blood feud, you know, where something really, really major and heated happens, before those guys can team up in some form or fashion and have it not feel weird? I'm going to have to go with 1 year, because that's just an easy marker to measure it. And, you know, you don't have to be an extremist like I was as a kid, where if two guys have a feud, They can literally not cross paths again unless, you know, they just start punching each other out of nowhere and lose control. That was the way I viewed professional wrestling once upon a time. But I just like to, you know, install my theory of 1 year, keep them apart after a heated blood feud.
Nothing for you. Come back 1 year.
In light of all this, it's a good thing that President Jack Tunney suspended Jake for the Survivor Series, so he was off the team and they weren't necessarily together in the end, where he was relegated to doing an interview with Mean Gene from the platform, where Jake wore one of the Cosbiest of Cosby sweaters on that Survivor Series show, and given recent events, one that's aged even worse than you might imagine.
You know the lady who lives here? She's 3 days late on her car payments. 3 full days! That ain't no lady. That's a car thief! Me, I'm the repo man. You know what that means? That means what's mine is mine. And if you're late on any payment, if you're late... what's yours is mine too!
This is a vignette for the repo man repossessing a woman's car after she was 3 days late on a payment, which was totally illegal by any standard. So he's a heel not because he is a repo man per se, and I've gone over this before, but because he's a corrupt repo man. Sort of like how IRS is not a heel because he's a tax agent, it's because he's a corrupt and overbearing tax agent. You can't repossess a car because it's 3 days late on a payment. What generally happens is there's a grace period of about 10 days. I mean, when I bought a car in 2008, it had it right on the little tickets that they gave me. It's kind of weird that they didn't have me repay it online, considering 2008. Actually, it was 2003. 2008 is when I would have paid it off. The fact that they didn't allow me to pay it online. So you get a 10-day grace period. Generally, it's 30 days before something would go into default. But as I've learned now, apparently, there is technology in place. And for the piece of crap cars of the early 90s, this wouldn't have been possible, where a lender can remotely disable a car if a payment is too late. So this allowed, I guess this kind of cuts out the repo man at the end of the day. So poor Barry Darsow, he doesn't even bother to really disguise his voice in this role, because it did not take me and probably many others long to figure out who this guy was. And now he's getting aced out like so many of us in the working world by technology.
Vic, I'll be honest with you, I love his music. I do. I'm a Michael Bolton fan. For my money, I don't know if it gets any better than when he sings "When a Man Loves a Woman." I celebrate the guy's entire catalog.
This song by Michael Bolton was only at number 3 for the November 16th American Top 40, but Bryan Adams and Prince could not keep Michael Bolton down as it went to number 1 the following week. It was only there for 1 week that I saw before it started falling backwards. So it was only so much America could take. And coming up next, we got Texas Tornado taking on Greg Green. And I'm just like, oh, the Texas Tornado in late 91 is not really much you can say, because there's not a lot going on. He's starting, you know, well, not starting to have his issues. I mean, clearly he was right in the middle of it. Does make me wonder, could he have been put in a tag team to maybe set himself up to fly right for the future, given that his drug arrest is only months away, that ultimately would lead to his tragic suicide? I'm not even sure you could do it, because I'd feel like you'd be punishing a guy, pairing him with Kerry and just babysitting him the entire time. And besides, how many drug-free and clean guys were there in that locker room at the time? So in light of all that, it's all depressing, and it's a 45-second match with Tornado. I was kind of curious that how bad were Tornado's back in 1991? And just looking up the tornado season, which generally peaks earlier in the year. There was a particularly bad tornado in Kansas on April 26th of 91. It was multiple violent tornadoes, including one F5, which was the only F5 in the United States in 1991, which tells you that, believe it or not, Brock Lesnar worked even less in 1991 than he does now. By the time you get to November, there's really not too much. As I said, tornado season is much earlier in the year, but there was an F4 tornado that killed two people near Springfield, Missouri, on the 29th of the month. Vince promotes the WBF magazine. I can't imagine who would have bought this. I guess this is just sort of entered the bodybuilding magazine field. Whatever. And there is an article in there, Myths About Bodybuilding and Nutrition, that Vince says is important to read so that you can learn the facts about staying in shape and all that. And this evolves into a conversation between Vince and Piper, like, oh, I'm going to let Ric Flair judge your nutrition, Roddy. Like, I don't know what exactly, what point they were trying to make there. And then Savage jumps in. And he makes a point that he screws up a common phrase that I can't believe he screwed this up.
And at the Survivor Series, everything will surface. The cream will rise to the crop.
Right there, Survivor.
Yeah, the cream is going to rise to the crop, all right? As well as the top.
Remember, Randy Savage, one of his most famous promos of the 1980s is when he pulls out the little coffee creamer and says, the cream rises to the top. The cream rises to the crop. He's getting his phrases confused. Cream of the crop is also a phrase that is used. It's also the name of a porn movie from the early 90s that when I was a freshman in high school, a friend of mine happened to have. You don't forget stuff like that even after a quarter of a century. Oh yeah, Tornado picks up the win with the discus punch. You know, I'm not exactly thrilled with his in-ring work, but as I said earlier, with Mel Phillips around, this is the only time that Kerry Von Erich was probably glad that he had a foot amputated.
I got something I want to say. This Wednesday in the Survivor Series, the Mountie, he thinks it's real cute to electrocute people, but when he steps in the ring with me in the Survivor Series, he's going to pay.
Well done.
Don't tase me, bro. Don't tase me. I didn't do anything. Ow!
Well, I mean, it was hilarious back in 2007 when Vince Russo got tased at that John Kerry speech. Wait a minute, what? Oh, wait, that wasn't Vince Russo who was getting tased? Oh, well. Some wishes don't come true. Seeing the interview here with Piper, Brett, Bulldog, and Virgil just kind of made the imagination think of a couple of things. Like, Virgil is the only American there. So in this post-Cold War world where the United States is the only superpower, we have Virgil as our representative on this great Survivor Series team. That's how confident we were as a country in 1991 that we would send out Virgil as our ambassador along with greats like Piper and Brett and Bulldog. The other thing looking at is I'm just glad that Bulldog isn't grabbing Brett by the waist like he did in the November 16th Superstars promo that these guys did, where it looked like they were posing for a prom date photo. That kind of made me, it did look a little weird. Even if two guys were going to the prom, I don't know if you would necessarily pose in that fashion. It just really struck me as awkward. But also that Brett would have famous matches against all three of his teammates, because Piper be upcoming at WrestleMania 8, British Bulldog at SummerSlam 92, when the Bulldog would be famously out of it and Brett would carry him by hook or by crook to a fantastic match. And then even later than that in 1992, Virgil during Brett's first WWF title reign as the fighting champion took on Virgil in an episode of the weekly TV pretty late in the year. Well, it obviously had to have been in the fall. I think it was around the time of Survivor Series 1992. And they've gone to the back now, the three announcers, Piper, Vince, and Savage, and they're going to interview the lovely Elizabeth to just kind of, I don't know, establish that she's there. I think that is the point of this, to establish that Elizabeth is in the building. And she's just asking, once again, appealing to Jack Tunney for Randy to be reinstated.
Yes, I'd like to say to Jack Tunney, Mr. President, please, please reinstate Randy. You're the only person who can do it. Please.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Elizabeth really does sound like Princess Leia there, with Tunney in sort of a Kenobi role, I guess. Maybe they could have put her as a hologram rather than just going backstage. But we had to establish that she's in the building. That's very important for something that happens later. So she's appealing to Jack Tunney to reinstate the Macho Man. And it gets me thinking about that angle back in 1988 when Bad News Brown was looking for title matches against the Macho Man Randy Savage, and he found that he wasn't getting as many as he might have liked, and he assaulted Jack Tunney on the Brother Love show. As it turns out, he may have grabbed him by the collar a little too tightly per Bruce Pritchard's account on a recent podcast. But anyway, he's accusing Elizabeth of doing favors to Jack Tunney to basically ensure that Bad News would not get any title shots. That is what he was insinuating back then, that the lovely Elizabeth was perhaps performing oral sex favors on the president of the WWF to protect her man, the WWF champion, which is very absurd. But in looking at this, did she do that back then? Probably not, because Tunney's not exactly doing her any favors right now. I guess Tunney's calling it the way he sees it. Or is Tunney looking for the same deal that he got in 1988? And maybe she did do something behind the scenes. Perhaps that's the case. But I think Liz should have been a little bit more aggressive with the case she was making to that tyrant, Tunney. Something along the lines of, you know, like make a graver threat. I mean, we're living in a world where the Cold War has just ended. Regimes all over the world are falling, some by surprise and some not by surprise. It would have been great if Liz had just turned it up from her usual demure style and said, "Hey, Tunney, you fucker, you remember what happened to that Romanian Ceausescu on Christmas Day in 1989? They dragged him and his wife out of the castle or wherever, their house, and they executed them in public on Christmas? Do you want that to happen to you? Because I will make that happen." If she had said something like that, first of all, it would have been a real departure for her character, I realize. But I do think at the end of the day, it might have helped her get things done without all the crap that would happen to Savage later.
Place Traditions, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceMedition.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the PlaceMedition Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Meet podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. all these shows, plus others available at PlaceMediation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceMediation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and HistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceMediation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Due to the likelihood of fear-induced heart attacks, we're offering all patrons million-dollar life insurance policies.
Life insurance? Might be able to borrow against the equity?
I don't know, sir. It comes free with the popcorn.
Is that air popped?
Skinner! We're losing valuable makeout time.
Now Skinner, not Seymour Skinner, but Skinner Steve Kern, is taking on Ben Jordan in our next match. And Steve Kern, this is a character that was created just from conversations between him and Vince, or really maybe even one conversation where Vince does the, "Oh, tell me about yourself, pal." I'm not going to sit here and do Vince impersonations for the entire podcast. I mean, it was what it was. He asked Kern what he was into, and he'd tell him about wrestling gators and that sort of stuff down in Florida, and bang, now the character is born. And Kern enjoyed doing it because he didn't have to be a pretty boy like he was in The Fabulous Ones. He could just kind of be a good old down-home Florida dude, which is much closer to the reality of what he was. And plus, being in the WWF in 1991, yes, things might have peaked already, but he's still getting paid, you know, a good amount, probably in excess of what he was getting earlier in his career when he's running on top with Stan Lane in The Fabulous Ones. So I have no problem with a guy like that who had an established career and then does a silly gimmick towards the end. He eventually becomes one of the Doinks. So another thing that he got to do that was probably fun in the moment. I mean, yeah, it is kind of ridiculous, but hey, if the guy gets paid, it doesn't really make a difference to me, and especially if they're happy with it. Like, if they're miserable in the role, like Greg Valentine pretending to play guitar, I don't really care what he says. He just did not look happy doing that. And Steve Kern appeared to be fine with being Skinner. He wasn't picking up a lot of wins or anything. He did challenge for the Intercontinental title against Bret Hart at the This Tuesday in Texas pay-per-view. So that's coming up shortly, which had one of my least favorite or most annoying Gorilla Monsoon lines ever at the beginning of that match when he says, "Skinner, for all intents and purposes, is undefeated here at the World Wrestling Federation." I'm like, oh, for all intents and purposes. Oh, okay. Either he is undefeated or he isn't. You can't be a little bit pregnant. In fact, he had, you know, been pinned cleanly at the Survivor Series the week before, but I guess that sort of stuff doesn't count. Some cheap shots early. He kind of suckers Jordan in where there, it looks like they're going to line up for a test of strength, and then he just kind of gets in the cheap shot. But on commentary, we do get a fun little moment here. Not a lot going on in a Skinner match. There's a lot of kick punch. I mean, he doesn't have to exactly work hard from a technical wrestling perspective, although he still could do it. Savage cuts a bit of a rhyme, and we have a nice... This is a lot of fun.
The winner gets dinner with Skinner.
Dinner with Skinner, a poet, huh? How about that?
I'm keeping...
Must run in the family, I don't know.
That has to be as close as we would ever get to an acknowledgement on WWF television that the genius Lanny Poffo and Macho Man Randy Savage are brothers. Because Poffo's whole gimmick, of course, is reading poetry first as a babyface, throwing a frisbee out into the audience, and then as a heel, just kind of ripping on babyfaces or whatever, and just kind of being an annoying manager. I don't recall anything ever coming that close. Now, granted, I have not seen every single bit of weekly TV. Not yet. Not yet. Of course, if I live to be 85 and I do one show every week, I still probably would not get to that entire time period. God knows enough stuff will be taken off YouTube between now and then. Skinner finishes things off with his version of the Scorpion Death Drop, the Slop Drop, the Gator Breaker, which is just kind of an inverted DDT move that as I recall, kind of got killed at WrestleMania 8. Because I think Owen Hart got hit with it in a match that lasted under 2 minutes, and he kicked out of it. So maybe that's a false memory on my part. But Skinner picking up a win over Ben, don't call me Michael, Jordan.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
That might not be the greatest idea in the world, just because it's Hulk Hogan time on the program, and when you mix Hulk Hogan and sex, bad things tend to happen. We've learned that over the last couple of years. First, they tell us that Hulkamania 6 is coming to VHS, and I don't know if they made a mistake here or what, but they said that it was going to be released on Thanksgiving Day, which seemed unusual, considering that back in 91, stuff wasn't opening on Thanksgiving for, you know, to get a head start on Black Friday or any of that stuff. Maybe in other areas of the country. I know that Massachusetts still had a lot of blue laws at that time that would prevent that. And in fact, still do. I know that, like, Walmart and stuff can't open on Thanksgiving Day. So Hulkamania 6 on VHS, you know, at that point, probably looking at those Desert Storm matches that I was talking about earlier. So we have Hulk Hogan on the interview platform, which is rather unusual because you have the funeral parlor, but he's in there last week, so you can't really use that again. The barber shop with his good pal Brutus the Barber Beefcake, that's on Wrestling Challenge. So the good old interview platform is really the only place he can go, but it's still kind of strange that Hogan is out doing an interview only 1 week after the historic beatdown on the funeral parlor by The Undertaker and Ric Flair and all that. Just seems like one of those Vince McMahon things that he would constantly do of, I know the cliche is we got to make Hogan look strong or Roman look strong, as people complain about these days. But it kind of lessens the impact of the beatdown on last week's show to trot him back out on the interview platform this week to promote the match at the Survivor Series on Wednesday. So it's a pretty standard interview for Hogan. There's not too much, at least differentiating it in the beginning anyway. But part of the way through, he does get a little poetic and explains why the official colors of Hulkamania are yellow and red.
Since it is our gravest challenge, I think it's time that I explain to all those little teeny Hulkamaniacs just what the red and the yellow stand for. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no Undertaker, brother. Simply because the yellow of Hulkamania will light up that valley of death. It stands for the belief in the training, the prayers, and the vitamins, and the light of Hulkamania will surely blind the Undertaker. But also, the red of Hulkamania, which guaranteed me immortality, brother. When the big man upstairs spilled his blood on this cross, he swore to me that Hulkamania would never die. That's what the red of immortality is.
Interesting to me that Hogan would talk about his color scheme, because for the first 3 years of his WWF run, he would occasionally bust out the alternate Hulk Hogan uniform system from time to time. The last time you saw him in anything other than the red and the yellow that everybody is accustomed to was June of 87 in MSG against Harley Race. Hogan would occasionally wear white trunks. You'd see him on TV early in his run wearing blue trunks. I know he wore blue against Dr. D. David Schultz back in Minneapolis. So this is something that he's kind of come up with over time. Or it's just some sort of bullshit that he came up with on the spot to kind of explain things with this Undertaker feud. And I've noticed that Hogan invokes God a lot more than your typical top guy wrestler, but not in the Ultimate Warrior sense, where he's talking about the gods and this and that kind of stuff and really making no sense. It's Hogan, more of a typical Judeo-Christian sort of ethic in his relationship with God. Now, there are some cynics out there, and I'm sure there might be some at the time, who hear Hogan talk about God in late 91 as the Zahorian thing is, you know, enveloping everybody, and, you know, obviously it's going to hit him at some point, that using God and religion and sort of hiding behind it can be the last refuge of a scoundrel. So anybody who was in the anti-Hogan camp may have felt that way at the time. But again, Hogan might have thought, like his fellow alliteratively named pal, Don Draper, if you don't like what people are saying about you, change the conversation. So Hogan's going to invoke God and all that against The Undertaker. And he goes on to explain why Undertaker, in a very cool moment on the funeral parlor, when he ripped the crucifix off him, he kind of drops it suddenly, almost like he's afraid of it, like there's some sort of power emanating from it. It's something I don't think I picked up on when I covered that episode way back. I just saw it as Undertaker just dropping it in disgust on his chest. But Hogan is making the point here that there is something from that crucifix, you know, which is Jesus dying on the cross for our sins, and Undertaker drops it right on Hogan's chest. So I don't know what he's getting at there. It's not something that he would do, you know, all the time, but it's kind of interesting that he's bringing up God in this context with a feud with The Undertaker.
But the thing, Mean Gene, that makes me realize I will survive the Survivor Series is when The Undertaker reached down and tore the crucifix off my neck. My neck went limp, brother. But as I smelt the dead flesh burning in the palm of his hand, the power of Hulkamania that he couldn't handle, he dropped the crucifix. And as it landed on my chest, it warmed my heart, Mean Gene, and it made me realize that I will survive the Survivor Series.
Now for our final Survivor Series report, where The Undertaker gets a bit of a rebuttal in advance of the match on Thanksgiving Eve. Which reminds me, night before Thanksgiving used to be fun as a young man. I went to a high school here in Massachusetts. Traditionally, there are football games played on Thanksgiving morning, and it's usually the big rivalry game. Well, my high school, we didn't have a rival. It's been in flux. We used to play Everett, which is a nearby public school, and we were getting our ass kicked, so we switched over to Don Bosco, which is was a Catholic school in East Boston. They went out of business. But when we started playing Don Bosco, we started playing the football game the night before Thanksgiving, which I liked a lot. Because I would go and hang out even after I graduate. You come back and it sort of becomes a mini reunion. But as you hit your late 20s and into your 30s, those type of things don't happen. And Thanksgiving Eve tends to become a night of horrific traffic coming home from work. At least in my world, I mean, maybe it's because I have a longer commute. So I generally try to work at home the night before Thanksgiving because I really want no part of it. So as I said, The Undertaker, he gets a bit of a rebuttal here to what Hogan was saying. He doesn't get the 2-3 minutes that the Hulkster gets on the interview platform. But it's always interesting to hear the dead man talking in his first years in the WWF.
The time is at hand, Hogan. There's no place to run. There's no place to hide. No heroes with chairs. And no crucifixes. Just the Undertaker's purgatory.
Undertaker saying that there would be no heroes with chairs is obviously referencing Piper and Savage coming around with chairs to save Hogan on the funeral parlor. But to the anti-Hogan contingent, Ric Flair was a hero with a chair. Hogan got hit with the tombstone onto the chair to end that match at the Survivor Series. So it's kind of an interesting, I don't think it was intentional foreshadowing, but just kind of funny. And speaking of funny, we got a promo with the Legion of Doom and the Big Boss Man. And this is during the Big Boss Man's feud with IRS, where things were starting to turn a little bit for him. He kind of really heated up all through 1990 and into 1991, and then he starts feuding with IRS, and I think it really just kind of stalled him out, quite honestly, especially since there was no real resolution to that feud because IRS just joins Money Inc. with DiBiase. DiBiase's feud with El Matador kind of gets cut off, and in part because of Hawk's issues, where the LOD quickly drops the titles in February of 92 to the Money Inc. team out in Denver. And there's nothing much to their promo other than, once again, Hawk, who a couple weeks ago on that AWA Pro Wrestling USA show kind of sounded a little weird, didn't say what a rush, said, "This is the end," at the end of the promo. And here, Hawk says something weird as well.
"Let's talk about knocking their teeth right down their throats all the way out of their sphincters. Let's not just talk about it. By golly, let's just do it."
It's just strange hearing Hawk talking like he's a character on Leave It to Beaver. So lest you think that nothing ever happens of consequence on these little update segments for the pay-per-views, we got Ric Flair and his team, and what a crew this is as well. Flair, Million Dollar Man Ted DiBiase, the Warlord, and the Mountie. So it's just the perfect mix of professional wrestling, just all in one team. And Rick has an announcement because Bobby Heenan was managing Ric Flair. Heenan had retired from managing but came back to manage Ric Flair on his way in, probably because they wanted to establish Rick to the WWF audience right away. And Bobby Heenan was always that instant heat magnet that could get anybody over as a top heel. You're not going to pair Rick with Slick, who's, you know, about to be gone or already is gone. You're not going to pair him with Jimmy Hart. No, you can only pair him with Bobby Heenan. But Heenan couldn't hack it with Ric Flair, as he famously said, it's like partying with Larry Flint or whatever. So Flair has an announcement, and the belt again is once again blurred, which, you know, just in case he decided to show his balls as well in this promo, it is a nice twofer you get from blurring the belt, because in case he decides to flash us, we get the little black dot or the pixelation as well of, you know, the baby's arm or whatnot. So he's got an announcement of a new executive consultant.
"It's hard to believe when you're on top of the world that things could get any better. But guess what? My new executive consultant has told me that from now on, everything will be perfect."
"Yeah. Woo! Just like everything else in my life, I'm here for one reason, to make sure everything remains perfect."
You remember how George Costanza wanted to be an architect, or at least pretend that he was an architect on Seinfeld? I think it's from that point that I decided that at some point in my life, I wanted to be an executive consultant for something, somewhere. I don't know what that is, and hopefully it will still happen someday. But it is something that I'm forever going to try to shoot for.
"Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me. Trust me.
When you hear "trust me," you should be immediately skeptical of what the person is about to say, no matter who it is, really. And those two words line up just behind "smell this" for a two-word phrase that should put you, you know, on your heels a little bit. When somebody says "smell this," they're probably not offering you like a candle or whatever. It's probably going to be they farted into a jar and they want you to take a whiff of it, you know, something like that. So Jake the Snake Roberts here, facing off against Bob Werner, who would later be known as Rock Werner, and you'd see him jobbing in WWF even as late as 1996. His last match that I could find was against Ahmed Johnson, so that's quite a range. This is his first match on record. So he's kind of a footnote here, And you say, okay, when they did the Cobra Bite angle, who was Jake's match against? And now you know that it is Bob Warner. And the match is so immaterial to everything that's going on here. It's only 42 seconds. And except for maybe Warner's mullet is definitely out of hand, I blame that on the parasailing accident of Brutus the Barber Beefcake, because at least when Beefcake was around, him giving haircuts to everybody served as a sort of de facto mullet control program. Things could not get, like, you'd see worse mullets in JCP or in WCW because Beefcake wasn't around to control things. In the WWF, you know, now things are, he's going in there with like Joe Dirt's hair from that movie. The crowd is eerily quiet during this match. They're not booing everything Jake does. They're just so extremely wary of him. Like taking a step back and like, all right, I'm going to give him space because, well, I don't trust this guy. So he finishes off Warner with the DDT. And instead of his usual bit, he gets on the microphone. And some of this might also be forgotten in this angle as well, because you have the announcer set up. Granted, they do the green screen thing, but they're in the arena towards the back. So Jake takes the mic and he starts goading Randy Savage and works in a dig at Piper as well.
Hey, yeah, you with the orange hat up there.
All right, Randy Savage.
Talking about Macho Man. Yeah, you looking at me, don't you look real sweet?
Easy, Mark.
You know something?
Just ignore the guy,
all
right?
There was a time in my life that I almost looked up to you. You were the Intercontinental Champion. You were the World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Champion at one time. I almost envied you. But you know what? I'm looking at you, and I'm thinking to myself, here's a man that used to be a real man.
Ignore him.
But obviously he's grown a little soft, hiding behind the skirt of a woman.
Just ignore him.
Easy, Macho.
So I tell you what, Macho Man, why don't you see if you can borrow Piper's skirt?
This kind of digs by Jake, or fairly normal. In fact, Savage would make similar accusations of Hulk Hogan in his rap album years later. Oh, be a man, Hulk. Stuff like that. But it also cuts a little bit deeper when you drill down and examine what was going on in Randy Savage's life at the time. As you see, he takes time off in 1991 after the retirement match, with a few exceptions, like the matches for SWS in Japan. But he's pretty much not wrestling on a full-time basis. And this was so that he could get off steroids so that he could have a child with Elizabeth. That never came to fruition for him, unfortunately. So to be called not a real man and to have those kind of things said about him has got to hurt, especially considering he was unable to conceive a child with his then-wife. I mean, we know, not to go back to Mad Men again, but you watch the first couple of seasons and Pete Campbell goes through believing that he's unable to have a child with his wife, all the while, you know, Peggy Olson actually had his kid and gave it away. But it's kind of, it takes a toll on a man who's trying to have a child and he can't. And you got Jake with these digs that are probably unintentional, but it's just kind of something that I think about, knowing the context of why Savage took that time off. And now you have Jake saying all these things to Savage. Not bad for a feud that was basically a complete audible, because the Ultimate Warrior got fired because he was just being ultra obnoxious. And Savage finally stands up and says he wants to take a closer look. So Vince and Roddy let him do that. And he walks down. And there is a referee there, and for years I always had it in my head that it was one of the Hebners, and apparently it's not. It's the guy who kind of looks like he has Jeff Daniels' haircut from Dumb and Dumber. I don't quite know what was going on with him, so I've been blaming the wrong person all these years. And Savage, Roberts keeps going and going with stuff about you are a yellow, gutless coward, and you're not going to get in here because of fear and all that sort of stuff. And when Savage does try to go in there, the referee grabs him and holds him from getting into the ring under the misguided assumption of Jack Tunney will not reinstate this man if he tries to get into a ring now. Well, that doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, you should let the man take care of his own business. If he feels that this is the right thing to do, you should not be stopping him. And Tunney wasn't reinstating him in the first place, so he has to take care of his own business. But this stupid referee, who I don't recognize at all, Lloyd Christmas, or whatever his name is, grabs onto his leg. Jake the Snake, he gets in the first shot. And all hell is about to break loose. And again, the crowd is so weird on this, because I think they're not quite sure what's about to happen here, as Savage is getting tied up in the bottom and middle ropes. So this is a little different than the usual Andre the Giant spot where he would, you know, fall into the top rope and then get his arms hooked. It's the same thing except with the bottom and middle rope. So the crowd is quiet because I don't think they're quite sure what's going to happen, because the Snake comes out of the bag. But you're watching wrestling and you don't think that you're actually going to see a real snake bite happening in the ring. But what they did not realize at that time is that they are watching late 1991 WWF, where all the rules have kind of been thrown out.
He's got it too close to it. Keep it away from it. That snake is trying. Wait a minute, the snake is running. The snake is running. Oh, the snake is biting it. The snake is biting it.
I'm out of here.
Roddy Piper on his way. To get some help, the snake is gnawing on the arm of Randy Savage, who's helpless, tied in the ropes. All I can say is that snake better be devenomized. It better be. Jake Roberts, look at it, shrinking the snake as the snake digs deeper into the arm of Randy Savage.
Now, Jake is kind of jostling the snake in what looks like an effort to make it dig deeper, which is actually what was happening, but in reality, what he was trying to do was to have it let go of Savage's arm because, well, enough is enough at a certain point, and Savage's left arm is clearly bleeding and all that. And by the way, had this taken place in Mexico, he would have had the snake bite the right arm, because that's the way things would be done in that country. Vince yelling, that snake better be devenomized. I mean, this is one of the all-time great Vince McMahon calls. At some point, I should make an accounting of my favorite Vince calls over time. As you recall, I wasn't exactly fond of Jimmy Hart got to the tugboat. Jimmy Hart got to the tugboat. I wasn't exactly fond of that particular call. So as he finally is, you know, trying to get the snake off of Savage, because enough is enough. We get Elizabeth running down, and we're going to turn the emotion on this angle up to an 11.
This is supposed to happen. Roddy Piper there. Oh, no. Elizabeth. I can't believe she's going to witness this horror. Elizabeth. Jake with a snake moving everybody back. The snake almost bit Elizabeth and Piper. Jake the Snake has lost it. He's lost it. And I don't think that snake has been devenomized. Randy Savage would have gotten up a lot earlier. Something's gone wrong here.
Liz is screaming. She's doing her role fairly well, and you have all the agents down there. Pat Patterson, who's wearing a white shirt, and I'm kind of thankful for that. Because I was watching something else. Maybe it was the Survivor Series match where he makes an appearance helping Hogan out of the ring after his match. And Patterson there is wearing a green jacket. And I have to admit, I don't remember the Masters that Pat Patterson won. I really don't. Piper, for his part, he runs down there. And he looks like, pardon my language, he looks like a complete asshole. Because he's running around and is in like the same hysterics as Elizabeth, it seems. But come on, Piper. You know, you're supposed to be on a certain level. You should stand up and at least try to fight. Yeah, the snake could maybe keep you back a little bit, but he's running around like a complete nutcase. He looks like a total ass. So Savage, they tried getting him onto a stretcher, but he rolled himself back into the ring. And this is what makes the angle particularly memorable to me. It's not even just the snake bite, as memorable as that is. It's just the fact that he goes back in and he knows, okay, so if you get bitten by a snake, things are going to happen. You're going to lose control, I guess, in some way. But Savage really kind of puts his own flair on it, no pun intended, where he gets back into the ring and he starts going after Jake, but he's flailing everywhere and he's just completely missing, almost like a guy who was in a bar fight after having 15 beers and like 5 whiskeys or what have you. And this also, this is another great Vince McMahon call that I like to quote in my everyday life.
Randy Savage! His equilibrium! Off as Elizabeth shrieks in horror! She can't believe what... That's her husband! Everyone out in ringside doesn't know what to do! Get him out of there! For God's sake, get Randy Savage out of there! Savage leaping back, and Jake, he doesn't know any better. Savage must be hallucinating by now. That poison going through his veins. Please, somebody get Randy Savage. Get him out of there, for God's sake. For Elizabeth to have to witness this. Roddy Piper with Randy Savage. Yes. Get some help.
Get him on there. Get him the hell out of here.
There's so much quotable Vince McMahon stuff just from this. He doesn't know any better. That would be one of my favorites. For God's sakes, get Randy Savage out of there. This is not supposed to happen. You know, stuff like that was not things we were accustomed to on wrestling television in the cartoon world of the WWF. And I think Vince McMahon really sort of matched the moment there. I can't picture any other wrestling announcer in history, no matter what you think of this angle, I can't picture anybody but Vince McMahon calling this as well as he did. In fact, I'd even hear out an argument that that's the last great Vince McMahon call for however many he may have had through the years. I mean, most of them would be in the 80s, and I'm sure there might be some in the 70s when he was more of just a straight-up announcer boy and all that. You know, that might be the last great one that we got out of Vince, and it was certainly worth it. So now they finally got Savage out of the ring. So we're going to get him on a stretcher. But this being the WWF, somebody got their jollies off this sort of thing, because we saw it with Superstar Billy Graham in 1988, which I covered in an earlier episode. I want to say it was like episode 22, where Greg Valentine injures Superstar Billy Graham by putting him in the figure four leg lock after Graham had tried to help out some jobber after a match. I believe it was Ricky Itake, of all people. And I may have been done with other guys too. I can't remember. They get Savage on the stretcher and they start rolling him. And once again, Piper, who is just completely negligent in this entire angle, he's like the main guy pushing it. And they start pushing him, but they don't strap Savage down in any sort of way. So Savage just kind of rolls off to the left and hits the floor. And Vince, oh no! And the director immediately cuts to proto Jonathan Lipnicki, or whatever, and shows him crying in his Hulk shirt in the stands. A lot of funny stuff. There's also the woman in the green rocker's cap who is shown kind of wincing or whatever during the snake bite. A lot of good directorial stuff. I have a lot of criticism for the way WWF shows are produced now, but this one was done pretty well.
Oh no! Complete chaos! Total chaos! Nobody knows what to do! Randy Savage hallucinating! They better get some help for that man! The poison is flowing through his veins! They better get some help! Randy Savage is in trouble! Savage is in trouble, I'm telling you now! God, is it not the
Jake Roberts has snapped. He's sick.
And they finally rush Savage to the back for the appropriate medical attention. Now that they remember to actually hold him down so he doesn't roll off the damn stretcher. And again, the production or the directors of this program get the absolute money shot here. And this is one of, not in the Val Venus sense. This is one of the best sort of framing that I've seen. You know, I'm not much of a director or whatever for television, but this is going to be one of the show images for this week that I'm going to rank up there with Terry Funk in the barroom fight about to hit Tony Greer in the back of the head, Hogan carrying Liz with Savage in the background with his palms to the sky like, what the hell? This is Jake kind of smiling on a knee or on both knees in the ring, and the snake kind of standing at attention, and they're looking at each other. Oh my God, what a frame job that is there. And it makes it just an ultra, I mean, holy shit, what a piece of business this was. And while the feud, oh, well, maybe they should have had the blow-off at WrestleMania 8. Well, Savage was busy winning the world title. Granted, kicking off a reign that didn't do much for business. But as I've always said, in 1992, nothing was really going to help business at that point. They were just sliding into a recession of the wrestling industry in the United States, at least. Jake and Macho Man Randy Savage, you know, for what it was, maybe not the greatest money program in the history of the WWF by any means, but it created a memory that when you think back, it's now 27 years since then, and the details of it, it's so well done, and it is one of those things where I remember where I was, you know, watching this and just kind of feeling it and experiencing it. And you know, it's the kind of thing that I'm not really feeling nowadays from WWE. They do a lot, they have good matches and stuff like that, but I don't really remember much of it after the fact. This is something that I still think about from time to time. Like I said, I think, you know, I quote the Vince McMahon stuff from time to time that he does during this angle. It's something that, for me, is going to live on forever.
We're back, and we can tell you there's other chaos in Randy Savage's dressing room. I mean, he apparently is receiving the appropriate medical attention. His condition somewhat stabilized. God, what a close call.
This is just a case of Vince being Vince here, where he comes on as the coda of the show just to let us know that Savage has been stabilized and that he's going to be okay, rather than letting us wonder what was going to happen as part of this episodic television. It's something that he had done before and had angles reshot in order to just kind of put the audience at ease somewhat. I'm thinking the Big Boss Man beating the hell out of Hulk Hogan on the Brother Love Show in 1988. We all remember the nightstick shots from the Boss Man to Hogan and the mace from Slick to the Hulkster. But what we don't really remember is, yes, he gets handcuffed to the guardrail. Most people don't really remember, or at least I hadn't, that Hogan, you know, lifts up the guardrail at the end and sort of chases them away. It seems like one of those things that he prefers when a babyface gets beaten down to get a little bit of heat back at the end. Even Snuka, when he gets hit with a coconut, comes at Roddy Piper, who ran out the door, and then Snuka kind of just bangs on the door after a while. Just one of those Vince things that he does. And maybe I'll be covering that Boss Man Hogan Brother Love thing coming up very soon. But that is how they end for WWF Superstars for November 23rd, 1991. But we're not done here. To wrap up, we'll do a quick edition of YouTube Comment Theater. And there are a few comments on this. This has been posted for quite some time now. The video has over 4,700 views at this point. 25 thumbs up and 1 thumbs down. So let's see what we have from the commentariat at this point. Lil Miss D says, Shawn Michaels' douchebaggery was starting to show here. You could tell he wasn't into it with Marty. Yeah, Shawn is definitely kind of being a little forward in terms of him being something of a jerk. As I said, he's Vinnie Barbarino after Saturday Night Fever, until he's just a little bit above the rest of the guys in that interview area. Pool Rat 1026 says, nice playful banter with Vince McMahon and Randy Savage, where Vince hints at the genius being family. Yeah, it's so, this is one of those things that I love covering on this show, is finding these little nuggets or wherever that I never would have noticed, because they usually don't do this sort of stuff on pay-per-view, or if it was on a pay-per-view, people would already know about it and talk about it. So to unearth this kind of stuff is really sort of fun. Roderick King says, due to action of a graphic nature, viewer discretion is advised. And yeah, that is a good point, that they did not use the big red X as they had done in previous angles, like Ron Bass and Brutus Beefcake in 1988, with Blackjack Mulligan and The Claw back in 82. They did not bring that back and censor anything for this, probably because they wanted to provoke the most visceral reaction possible. Chris Napoleon says, that was deplorable. And yeah, sicking a snake on a guy is about as bad as it gets. But that's Jake Roberts' 1991 heel work for you. The sad thing about that whole thing is that the snake ended up dying as a result of this. And I don't know too much about snakes, but suffice to say, Randy Savage kind of took responsibility and said, ooh, yeah, I poisoned the snake with my own venom. something to that effect that he said in the aftermath. And Kim Martin says, why did WWE blur the big gold bell? And yeah, it was basically because a court agreement had been reached in the week between last week's show and this week's show, where they could no longer show that belt on television that is the intellectual property of World Championship Wrestling. But it would be a little while before that belt would be returned to that promotion. And that'll do it for YouTube Comment Theater. Now for next week's show, I had mentioned that I wanted to get back to doing a WCW Prime, but none of them are on YouTube. However, they are out on Daily Motion, and I managed to grab one of them. So you will be able to watch this, just on a different platform, and I'm not going to upload it to YouTube or anything like that. And this would be the WCW Prime from March 11th, 1996. Hosted by Dusty Rhodes and Chris Cruz, which is a prerequisite for any Prime episode that I'm going to do. And the Moo match of the week certainly caught my attention. The Nature Boy Ric Flair facing off against Das Wunderkind Alex Wright. I'm very excited about that one. They have a couple of uncensored 96 control centers. A pay-per-view that, well, I'm going to have to check out again for the ridiculous cage match main event that featured an 8-on-3 battle at the end. And some of the matches you're going to see on next week's show, the Armstrong brothers, Brad and Steve, taking on the Blue Bloods, but no Regal here. It's David Taylor and Robert Eaton. The Renegade will be taking on the Gambler. That's a rather interesting matchup. I'm sure now there'll be a lot of Renegade Gamblers out there, now that sports gambling has been opened up to all 50 states. I'm sure that I'll find a way to say something about that. Men at Work against the Barrio Brothers. I feel like I've seen that match before. Maybe it was High Voltage. I kind of get all those D-level teams in WCW confused. And the Shark is taking on Dave Sullivan. Now, it says Dave Sullivan, not Evad. So we'll see what it is on next week's show, WCW Prime from March 11th, 1996. Thank you so much for listening, and don't forget to leave a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Music, or whatever, and to check out the other great podcasts on the Place to Be Nation Network, Place to Be Nation Wrestling, the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and also on Place to Be Pop for various comics, podcasts, and pop culture, and whatnot. And also to check out my friends at the Our Vantage Point podcast, Joe Murata and Michael Quinn. And, of course, the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing with Mike Crockett and Tetsuya Naito's number one rival, Brian Malonis. They recently squared off in a 6-man match in LOL that I'm so sad that I ended up missing that show because Brian talked about it being the biggest moment of his career. You know, being in Lawley City where, he, as he pointed out, he won the Chaotic Wrestling Championship on three separate occasions. I had a lot of fun listening to that episode recently. So check all that out and do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Savage out of there. He doesn't know any better.